ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome back to The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts. My name's Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here in Oshkosh. And with me on this special edition is my partner in crime,
Connor Madison. I'm the staff photographer here and I guess local or residential air racing expert, something like that.
I love it.
Self-proclaimed.
Well, the minute we have air racing questions, we always come down to Connor. So, yeah. Well, thank you, Connor, for joining us. And Connor, do you want to tell everybody who we're going to be talking to today?
Yeah, so we have the pleasure. Joining us today is Skip Holm, who's a Vietnam veteran, Air Force pilot, Lockheed test pilot, and of course, absolute air racing legend.
Skip, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad to be here.
Well, awesome.
I enjoy the cool weather.
Yeah, you just got in from L.A. last
That's
night.
That's right. We get rid of that 78-degree stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, right into the cold, hardy weather here. Yep. Getting ready for a snowstorm here soon. So. Yeah. Yeah, so, well, thank you for coming out. You know, one of the questions I always love to ask, and I think anybody that listens to this knows it, is, you know, what first got you excited about aviation? What was your first sort of spark?
Oh, this is like the other podcast where the guy looks at it and says, ah, a good question. I have a lot of pictures when I was, a kid, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, all in those age groups where I wore a beanie with the propeller on it. And I never used to think too much of it, except that I'd look up. I was born in North Dakota, and all the airplanes flew over North Dakota. They didn't land, there was no oil there, so there was no reason to go there. And so I think that my first look at wanting to do something with an airplane was when, the airplanes flew over, and I got my little hat with the prop on it. And somehow or another, I thought that prop would maybe get me into an airplane. And I was about 18 when I had my first airplane ride. I actually got to touch an airplane, and so that's, and that was pretty significant.
Wow. What kind of airplane was it?
It was a Bug Smasher to begin with, but my next one was a T-Bird, and that one we had in the middle of winter in North Dakota, landed it on an icy runway and went skating off to the side. It was an Air Force colonel who was flying it. And he did manage to keep it on the runway, but it was real exciting. And I thought, wow, I want to do this. I want to slide along the ice in a rocket-propelled airplane. Yeah. Anyway, awesome. When we got back to his office, he took his wings and he took them off his chest and threw them on a table. And he said, I'm never going down again. And I thought, whoa, that's all I need is a little piece of wing and stick it on and I'll be able to fly a jet around And that's about all you need, that little thing, and a fuel card.
Well, so I guess how did the trajectory come about for your career to join the Air Force? How did you make that decision?
Actually, when I went to college, I signed up and I joined the Navy, believe it or not. I didn't really know it. And I was in the Air Force ROTC, and the Navy boys came to invite me down to Pensacola. And I said, well, I'm in the Air Force. And they said, no, you're in the Navy. And so those two got together and, the Air Force and the Navy, and I stayed in ROTC and graduated and got my, second lieutenant barge from the Air Force, not from the Navy.
That's interesting. So you had a armed forces battle over you.
Yeah, right. In retrospect, Pensacola was not a great place to go because all their boys went out to the carriers out in the South China Sea, and a lot of them got shot up and shot down. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you would end up going on to fly the F-105.
Yeah. We were the first. We were losing a lot of airplanes, a lot of 105s. And, the 105, people don't know this, but it's the only airplane ever pulled out of the Air Force for not being good enough. We kept losing too many 105s. And actually, when my 105, I went to Karat with that, and we lost so many airplanes that we finally took that base and closed it down. And then I moved over to another one in Thailand. But the 105 was a great airplane, though. So the loss rate. And because they expected it to do something that, you know, airplanes nowadays, even the only the F-35 is the only one that's kind of able to, you know, fly where the 105 flew and still, can still come back.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting to say, you know, I've read a bunch about, you know, the loss rates that have everything, but you enjoyed flying it, though.
Oh, it was just a super airplane. I mean, super. I mean, you got to think about when you can give a second lieutenant a Mach 2 airplane and turn him loose over a continent, I mean, things are going to happen that aren't going to be great. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those did, you know, and I had a lot of times as a lieutenant, you know, you learn to, you know, to admire, and you know, the colonels who are guiding you, right? As a squadron commander, I had Black Matthew, the guy that broke all the windows in the academy. You know, that was my hero. And I was in the training at the time when he did it. And he, you know, he broke $1 million worth of windows, you know, in the Air Force Academy. And I had an airplane. I was on standby down in Colorado Springs. He came back from the flight and he said, oh, they're gonna get me now. They're, you know, you can't break $1 million worth of windows and get away with it. But believe it or not, they took the airplane, sent it to Edwards, and Edwards said, airspeed's off. He was reading the wrong airspeed. So somehow the windows got put back in again and everybody was happy.
So do you have so in the F-105, what kind of missions were you flying? What were you doing over there with them?
Mostly, you know, bombing missions. And, you know, we flew almost like 1,500 miles in a combat sortie, which is a lot of distance. You know, and so we'd hit a tanker after takeoff. Actually, we'd take off with 105, and everything is in full burner because you need more power. And we loaded the airplane so heavily. You know, it would roll, you know, 7,000 feet for takeoff. And when you pull the gear up, it would settle back into the runway again. And if you couldn't quite make it, you'd jettison stores even on the roll. And then we'd leave it in burner until you'd take off in burner, climb in burner, level off by the tanker. If you didn't have enough power to stay with the tank, you'd light the burner again. You know, so you sit on the tanker and burner while you're sucking the fuel out of the tanker.
Oh,
and then you had four airplanes per, you know, 707. And we'd call them to toboggan. And what that means is that you've run out of power on the fighter and you need the big airplane to push the nose over to help out. So pretty soon you'd go from 15,000 feet down to lower and lower, and you'd be down around, you know, 11,000 to 12,000 feet refueling.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
I never thought about being on the tanker with the afterburner lid.
Yeah. You can see quite a few pictures. Finally, they made it so that the afterburner was stageable. So you could get on the tank in full burner, and then you could pull the power off a little bit. But the 105, though, when you think about it, the flaps up speed on the airplane was like 560 knots. I mean, when I went to Reno to fly Genie, you know, I looked at the side of the airplane and Genie had 432. And I thought, 432, why? I could almost open the canopy at that speed. And then when they asked me what I thought about Genie, you know, all I could really say is that, well, I could put the gear down. I know I could put the gear down and race this airplane and beat these other guys. And so I wasn't too impressed with Genie, really, you know, until I flew it. And then because you're putting out an immense amount of effort to make a prop job go 500 miles an hour.
Wow. Do you have a mission? Because as we're progressing through you know, we're going to get to the air racing portion pretty quick here, but do you have a mission in the F-105, like one particular one that stands out for you over all these years?
Well, I have several in both airplanes, both the 105 and the F-4. But one in the F-105 would be, you know, we used to come back from missions and play games with the you know, do Aileron rolls on each other, you know, and you know, we had another one where we'd come over the big lake north of Tocley and let down, had to see who was going to buy the beer, right? You got to figure that out before you get on the ground. And so the lead would start lowering and see whoever hit the water first would buy beer. That's pretty much it. I don't mean hit the water, I mean just barely touch it, because then barely touching it, the guy would be afraid that you're going to get too deep and he would nose the airplane in. So you just put a streak on the water, and that meant you bring your billfold and buy the beer.
That's crazy.
And also, I put a it's a guided bomb. You know, at the time they were new things, and I had the target as a Buddhist temple, right? And so we bombed a Buddhist temple, and ironically, things came flying out of the temple. And it turns out to be, it was hair dryers with the, remember the old kind of hair dryers that had the hose on it, and it had the thing you put the cap you put over your head, and anyway, it turns out that they misordered. I guess it was only one digit off when they ordered a new set of bombs, right? And it came out to be hair dryers instead of bombs. So I thought it was kind of a, kind of an inside joke from the people that run the universe here, is that, hey, it's drop hair dryers, not bombs.
Well, and did your F-105, did you have one specific to you, like that had a name on it or anything? Or?
Yeah, we had our own airplanes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I never had mine shot down. It had shot up a little bit. But you don't dare go on R&R or anything, because you come back and somebody's lost your airplane.
Wow. What was yours named? Did you have nose art or anything?
Oh, the, who's that, the comic guy that comes and grinds through trees and stuff like that? You know, the devil, the da-da-da devil.
Oh, Tasmanian devil.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I had it on the airplane, I had it on my flight suit, I had it on my bed, I had it on everywhere.
That's awesome.
You know, that was a lucky thing to have at the moment.
Wow.
Yeah,
I still did burn the hooch down, though. I started drinking, not drinking, smoking one day and forgot you got to put those things out.
Oh, no.
And so I went to sleep and burned the hooch down and burned down my Theta Chi jacket. Ironically, you don't take a fraternity jacket into a war zone, but I did. So I quit smoking that day also.
Yeah, so I guess kind of capping off your combat career, as I understand, you have more combat hours than any Air Force pilot ever. Is that correct?
Well, I say than any pilot, right?
And I used to
say that, and one time there was a guy way in the back of the room and said, I don't think so. I said, what'd you say? He said, I don't think so. I said, what don't you think? And he says, you couldn't have possibly more combat time than anybody on the planet. And I said, well, yeah, I think I do. And he says, well, how about the big airplane guys that used to take off and fly for, you know, 3 days and then finally land? They were all getting combat time. I said, okay, I'll give you that one. And then he says, how about the other guys? And he went on and I said, I'll give you that one. Pretty soon he got down. He says, I guess there's nobody that you can really say that you have more combat time than anybody. And I said, well, how about UFOs? I mean, how much combat time do they get? I mean, they're always airborne, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, so I'll give it to the UFO folks.
So you transitioned from the F-105 to the F-4. How did you like that transition? What did you think of the F-4?
Oh, the airplane is great. The transition itself I didn't particularly like, because I was overflying 105s and we were losing pilots and losing right and left. And then we had a colonel come from personnel, and he came to me and he told me that he was going to give me my prime assignment. And he said, I'm going to give you a B-52 down in Texas. And I said, well, I don't want a B-52. I want a real airplane. Give me a fighter. He said, nope, you've had your fighter. You've gone from two different bases and bombing, and you deserve a bomber. And he left. And lo and behold, I got a piece of paper in a few days later that said I had a bomber. This was the days when they had the machines where you could send a letter by, you know, a fax machine, only you had to turn the knob, right? And so I wrote a letter back to him. I said, you know, I don't want your B-52, rather. I don't want to fly it. I don't want to be part of it. And if you force me to fly it, I will eject on the first takeoff. Because it had seats in it, hot seats, right? And so I sent this thing on the fax machine. I was sitting there turning this knob, you know, and it was slowly grinding that letter off to the guy. And I thought, am I making a mistake or what here? You know?
Yeah.
And I said it kind of out loud. And somebody was in the office and said, you had a mistake on how you run the fax machine? And I said, no, I have a mistake on how I wrote the letter. And anyway, the letter got to the colonel, and he sent me back one right away. He says, I don't want you in my 105. I don't want you in my state. I don't want you in my country. I don't want you in my Air Force. And if you come back here, I will give you Article 15, and that'll be your last of your career. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's not good news. So I went right up and volunteered for another third tour, and they gave it to me. And then when my third tour ran out, then I thought, here we go with the B-52 again, because this guy hadn't retired yet. And so I volunteered for an F-4 tour. Figured that'll fix him. And I thought, no, he's smarter than I am. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to say I want to go to Europe in an F-4. And then he'll say, if you love combat that much, I'm going to send you back to Saigon in a desk job. So anyway, I got the orders to go to Saigon. And somewhere when going through the Philippines, I got on the phone and called a guy in my old squadron up in Karat. I used to fly 105s for it. He gave me a slot in fly the F-4. So all's well.
What was your first reaction to the F-4? What did you think of it?
Well, they're all two-seat airplanes, so I got an IP in the back seat, right? And actually, we go out to take off with the airplane, and you push the power up and get in the burner, and it's got a soft burner. For one thing, you can't really hear it, like a thud would bang, right? And then on the thud, we have a gauge we dump water into the motor to increase the density of the air, so we get more thrust. And if you don't dump the water in there, the airplane won't get off the ground. It would just roll right off the end. And then the F-4, it had all kinds of power. You push it in a burner, and away the airplane goes. And boy, the thing gets airborne really quick. And when it hit 350 knots, I pulled both burners out, and I thought both motors had quit. That's how much drag the F-4 had.
Wow.
Yeah. Figure that out, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought both motors had quit, and I just shoved them both back in again because it had a relight way on the top end. So you'd hit the relight to start them, you know, to get the flame back in the engine again. And I thought one of these you'd probably catch. And then the IP in the back seat grabs the handles and pulls them. He's pulling them out, and I'm pushing them in. And then he said, what are you doing? I said, both motors quit. He said, no, they didn't. You just took them out of burner. And I said, wow, this thing has more drag than 3 105s put together. And the F-4 does have a lot of drag. It's hard to get the puppy to go supersonic.
Wow. Now, was that air-to-air missions you were flying, or?
No, in the F-4, both the Thud and the F-4 were bombing sorties, generally. Yeah, we did some CAP and some, but, the bases that were close to Vietnam were the ones that took most of the MiG flights.
Wow. Now, after flying through Vietnam, you went on to become a pilot, test pilot, flew a lot of different aircraft in the Air Force. What are some of the highlight aircraft you consider your career that you flew in that stage of your career?
I tried to fly all of them. And then I also had a deal where if it didn't have a gun, I didn't want to fly it. And then it didn't have any bullets for the gun, I didn't want to fly it. You know, most of the Century Series fighters, I flew all those, and other airplanes like the U-2, I flew that, and some of those I was assigned to their squadron, you know, rather than just flying the airplane. But Edwards, though, if there's an airplane sitting there, you could go fly it, because that's the idea behind being a test pilot, is that you should be able to fly most airplanes. I had some things at Edwards, that are significant. One of them was a spin in a T-bird. It got away, and reached down to jettison the canopy, and the canopy wouldn't jettison. So, and I also, I didn't, there was a marina in the front seat, and I was giving him a ride, is what it was. Anyway, so we're in this spin with this T-bird, and it's oscillating between plus four and minus four, just woo, 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 woo. You know, so you'd be up in the seat for a while and down, and it was started at 35,000 feet, so you had a lot of time to spin, and it was out of control. I couldn't control it with the stick anymore, and I didn't know it, but the front seat of the Marine had pulled the handles on the ejection seat, and the seat didn't work, so my seat was hot because he'd pulled the handle on his seat, right? And anyway, I reached down and found out one of the oscillations. I'd been watching it, and also I taught it in class, is that when you're in a spin, an uncontrollable spin, find something, jettison tanks, put the gear down. I mean, open the canopy, do whatever you think is smart, or even if it isn't, do it anyway, because you got to get out of this spin. And what happened is when it got down around 8,000 feet, and Edwards is 35, so you're pretty close to the ground, that I figured that we had hotter air, you know, thick air. Airplanes like thick air rather than thin air, right? Yeah. And rockets like thin air. Yeah. But anyway, I jettisoned the canopy at the right point, and it pushed the nose down. The airplane recovered. You know, the canopy's, you know, the windscreen held the wind back a little bit. And for every case that I've ever had to get rid of a canopy, the helmet has not stayed on.
Wow.
But the hose has always stayed connected to the helmet. So believe it or not, you can reach over there and pull the helmet back in, put the helmet back on.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah. And anyway, couldn't get the gear down on the T-Bird. So finally, the Marine wasn't going to help anymore because he was sitting in a hot seat, and it's probably going to kill him because we were too low if it went off, right? So I got the airplane on the ground, taxied it up. You know, everybody was all it had been on big TV on Edwards, so everybody had been watching it. And so they're all sitting around the airplane. I get out of the airplane, and the Marine is still sitting in the airplane. And the squadron commander says, "How about your buddy there? Is he getting out or what?" And so I go over there and say, "Hey, you can get out now. Let's." And he said, "Well, I did something." We all thought he just went to the bathroom in his pants, right? But he'd actually pulled the handle, and he said, "The seat is hot." I said, "Whoa, how come the seat is hot?" Well, he pulled the handle. And then the commander was listening, and he looks at the Marines and said, "Son, you were going along for a ride. Did you hear an order to evacuate the airplane or pull the handles?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well, you know, as soon as you get out, we're going to court-martial you, so hurry up and get out." And he said he wasn't going to move because the seat would fire, so we finally figured out how to get him out of there without having the seat fire. But prior to that, one guy had run into the squadron and got the board where you bet on games, right? So we were betting on when that seat would fire, is what it boiled down to. You know, you'd throw your money in and you'd say, "Give me 2 minutes, give me 30 seconds. You know, this seat's going to fire in 4 hours or something, but it is going to fire. So whoever is going to win, this, you know, there'd be hundreds and thousand bucks there for the guy who got the right time." But anyway, the seat did not fire. So we got him out, and he got in his car and left the base and resigned from the Marines and went to work in United in Denver.
Wow.
But that was the one thing that happened at Edwards. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The funny part about the airplane T-Bird spinning was that I was the instructor at the test pilot school that taught the spin course. And so when we talk about recovering, I'd say, well, if you're sitting in an airplane and the thing won't recover and you use all the controls and you use the motor, I mean, shut the engine down, you know, run it full up or do something with it. Don't just sit there and crash. And then I said, then worse gets worse, get rid of the canopy, throw the wheels down, throw the flaps down. I said, "If you have a passenger, throw that person out." I said, "Do anything. He's got a parachute. You know, you're saving the airplane for the Air Force, so you can have your fight after you've all recovered and gone to the bar."
Wow! So you go out and you start flying. As you mentioned, you know, flew the F-117 and you were flying out at Area 51, which is impressive.
Yeah.
That's got all the mystique around it and everything.
Yeah, right.
What did you think of the F-117?
Oh, the 117. They're still, you know, a great airplane, still great, still better than the others. You know, it's still being used.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is the primo stealth airplane, even over the J-35.
It's just such an airplane that, you know, it's interesting. Like, they had sort of said, oh, yeah, they're all retired. And then just recently they started popping back up and, yeah, and they're still out flying them. So.
Yeah, it's an airplane that, actually, I was working on a movie set at the time we were doing that, and they were using a drone. They had a drone in there, and they wanted me to come look at the drone. And so I went to this one building, the one guy was building the drone, and it was flat, and he was using flat pieces of plywood, and the thing looked like a small 117. And he said, here's our idea of a drone for the new, and I said, nope, it won't work. And he says, why? I said, nobody will believe it'll fly. A flat thing, it won't fly. And he said, well, we got it done. Now we're going to use it. I said, no, you're not. You can't use it. I mean, I'm your advisor, and no, we can't use that. You got to use a blended shape. I said, it won't work if you do a flat one. And I thought, plus, I'd go to jail. Yeah. And that movie is still out there, and it does not have a flat drone.
That's funny. So yeah, how did you get into air racing? What was that?
Well, I was sleeping in my boss's office. That's where it all started. And the phone rang, and it was Dave Zuschel on the other end, and he was talking to Bill Park, who was my boss. And somewhere in there, Bill hands me the phone. He only takes the phone and puts his hand over it, and he says, "Remember, half your time is in that airplane." Got that? I said, yeah. So he opens and takes his, and he starts talking to Dave again. And then he hands the phone to me, and he says, here, Dave wants to talk to you about flying his F-86. And so Dave takes. And I get the phone, and I said, hi, Dave, you have an F-86? And he said, yeah. He says, can you come fly my airplane? And I said, yeah. And he says, you got any time in an F-86? And I thought, aha, this is it. This is where I say half my time. So I said, half my time is in an airplane. He said, wow, that's a lot of time to have an F-86. Where'd you get the F-86 time? And I thought, well, here's when you lie, you get caught, right? And so I said, I was at a base in Thailand that flew F-86s. And that's all they said. And he thought that meant that I flew them too, but I'd never flown it. So I did go off and fly it. And then, and not Reno week, but like the week before Reno, the Saturday before the Friday race, right? And it was on the Friday, I think, I was up at the site, and the phone rang, you know, the big red security phone. And somebody picks it up and said, here, Skip, it's for you. So I take the phone, and I thought it was somebody, you know, somebody from us, you know, Lockheed. And it turned out to be Dave Zuschel, and he's on the phone. And I said, Dave, how did you get this line? This is high security. And he says, oh, you guys at the Lazy L never change anything. And he used to call Lockheed the Lazy L because they said they never do anything. And I said, well, you can't be using their phones. And then he says, do you want to fly a racer? And I said, yeah. And he says, next weekend? I said, yeah, and just to get him off the phone. So anyway, he hung up, and then I called him back, and I called Bill Park up and said, your Zuschel guy wants me to fly a racer. And he said, yeah, go ahead and do it. He said, no harm. You know. So I went up there and flew the airplane up there, and I had 30 minutes about in a P-51 when I got there. And we'd gone through a lot of other stuff just to get it off the ramp at Van Nuys. Yeah. And one of them, Wiley, who owned the airplane, he came to Van Nuys to meet me to see if I was going to be his guy or not to fly the Genie, right? So we're sitting there, and to make a long story short, you know, he looks at me and he said, so do you have any Mustang time? How much Mustang time do you got? And he's a Southern boy, you know, from Alabama. You know, that's, hey, you all Mustang boy, how much time you got, you know? And I said, I don't have any Mustang time. Okay, how about tail dragger time? You got some big tail dragger time? I said, no, I never flown. I thought of it later, I had U2, and that's tail dragger. and hard tail dragger, too, by the way. And and then he says, so I guess you got, you got big engine time? And I said, no, I don't have any of that. And I thought right there, Zuschel is sitting across from me, and Wiley's right next to me, and he looks to me, and he doesn't really say anything, but I know he's thinking, right? And pretty soon he gets up, digging in his pocket for the quarter to call the real pilot, right? Let's get somebody here who knows what a Mustang looks like. And so anyway, he goes over to the phone, and Zosha looks at me and he says, quick, tell him something. And I said, Wiley. He says, what? I said, I did race a couple of airplanes in the old 800 miles one time. And he looks at me and he says, what was that? And so I raced two MiGs across Laos. And he said, oh, that'll do it. what I didn't tell him, it isn't, when you say I had air-to-air with two MiGs or chased two MiGs, you think that I was the guy in the back chasing the guys who were in the front to shoot them down, right? But it was the other way around. They were the guys in the back. I was the guy in the front just trying to get away.
Wow.
Yeah. So that Genie, you know, the airplane we're talking about, for people that aren't familiar, I mean, that airplane had the smallest canopy of any Mustang ever. Like, you couldn't wear a helmet in there. You had to wear a headset. That's how small the canopy was, right?
I can attest to that.
Yeah.
No, just to get the airplane out of Van Nuys and fly it was unheard of in 2 days.
You know? Yeah.
And actually, I finally got in the airplane, got the engine started, was going to taxi out in Van Nuys. I couldn't get the damn thing to turn. You know, I put the rudder way in and push on the brake, and it wouldn't turn. So I thought, this is a fight between the airplane and the pilot, right? Who knows more, the airplane or the pilot? and so I started jacking away on the brake and bumping the tailwheel off the ground. You know, and then which when you see people do that with the Mustang, you say, what are you doing? You know, take that gorgeous airplane and you're ruining it. And finally, everybody came running out with their hands up and nobody shut down. So I shut down. Azushla comes over and he says, is that tail, tailwheel steering messing up again? And I thought, oh, tailwheel steering. This thing's got steering. And because they never wanted me to look in a manual, on a P-51 manual, because it's nothing like Genie. I kept talking to Dave and saying, it's got to be something that, you know, the way you adjust the seat, it's got to be the same. And the Genie is in, he's, nope, don't go. And plus, what he really meant is nobody's going to insure you. Nobody's ever going to let you get into an airplane because they don't believe you can fly it and they don't want to wreck. And the insurance is too high and nobody's going to do it. That's what he really meant.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, he says, so Dave has got his hand in there moving the stick around. And I'm watching them, and finally he says, there, that should do it. He says, see if that'll do it. And then I said, oh, here we go. The hard part, I got to start this thing back up again. I had trouble starting it the first time. And so anyway, I finally got the thing cranked, and I taxi out and get on the active, and tower clears me for takeoff. And again, I got an Air Force uniform on, Air Force boots on, and Air Force stuff on, right? Getting in, and I was one of the first guys that ever wore a helmet in a P-51, I think, at Reno.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm rolling down starting to roll down the runway there in Van Nuys, and I reach over and salute, like we do in the Air Force, right? And so I look at the people I'm saluting to, and I salute, and I'll be damned if my head didn't get stuck in that little canopy, right? And I couldn't get my head straight. And so I'm trying to grab my mask and pull it down, and nobody wears a mask in that airplane either, right? And now I know why. But so anyway, I'm pulling it in the meantime. I let go of the airplane, and the airplane just goes back on the ground again, and it goes off in the grass. And I finally get my head straight, and I look and see where I am. And boy, I'm out in the middle of the runways out on the grass. And I thought, this thing lived its life in the grass. So, you know, so much. It's never seen a runway anyway. Who cares? And so I just reached over and added more power and kept right on going down through the grass and got airborne. And then, so David, he comes over there, and then he says, everything okay with you then? And I said, yeah, everything's fine here. But it wasn't. And then I finally had one of the gauges in the cockpit start going up. And I called David and I said, one of these gauges is increasing. Should I care? I said, there's only a few in here, and you'd think you wouldn't put a mess of gauges in there. If you only go down to one gauge, it's got to be something that'll cover everything, right? You'd think. And he said, what's it say? And I said, where's it at? And so I'm reading it, and I'm looking, I said, I'm telling where it's at, and I said, it says coolant. I said, what's coolant? And he said, that's water. And I said, "You mean like a radiator?" And I said, "He said, yeah." And I said, "What's happening?" He said, "You're losing water or losing something." He said, "You're having a problem. Get on the ground." And I thought, "Oh, this is, you know, one more thing on a first flight you probably don't want to do too many times." But anyway, I finally got landed and taxied in. We found a coolant leak in the coolant tube. Yeah, so then got another flight.
Wow, that's crazy. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And I was ready to go then.
Yeah, I bet, yeah. So you showed up at Reno then, 30 minutes of Mustang time, and you're going to go out and qualify Genie. And like at that time, no one had ever gone, like maybe the qualifying record was in the 440 mile an hour or something like that. So you won.
Yeah. We were on the ramp. Dave was doing his favorite thing, which is just monkeying with his motor, trying to get it to last 100 miles, right? And anyway, there was a guy come walking toward us with a pencil and a piece of paper. And Dave looks at me and he says, that's Phil from the local press here. And he's probably going to want to talk to you. And I said, okay. So he comes over and talks to Dave for a while. And they're chit-chatting over there. And then finally he turns around and walks over to me. And he says, he introduced himself that he's from the local paper. And he says, "So are you flying Genie?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Okay." He says, "How fast are you going to go?" And I thought, how fast am I going to go? And I thought, well, I was prepared for questions. He said, "I thought he'd ask me, what is the min range of an AM7 or a min range of AM9 or something like that, something important." And all he wants to know is how fast I'm going to go. And that's when I looked over the side of the airplane that I mentioned a little while ago and saw 432. I thought, 432, well, that is nothing. Yeah, that I thought would happen. And before that, I told Dave Zuschel, he said, "The Mustang looks too thick." You know, when he opened the door and showed me Genie, he said, "What do you think of that airplane?" And Genie was pretty slick. And I looked at it and I thought, "It's too thick." He says, "Too thick." He said, "What does that mean?" And I said, "Right where the cockpit is, the airplane's too thick. The air has to come around the prop, come around this, come around the fuselage. It's too thick." And he said, "That we better close the door, close the hangar door and let you look at it some other time." Because they really got offended. And anyway, so I'm sitting there talking to Phil, and he's waiting for my answer, you know, how fast you're going to go. And then I look at him, I say, "I'm going 450. He says, "450? He says, "You know what this piece of paper is?" And I said, "No." And he said, "That's the timesheet." And he says, "We have all the speeds that you're going to go, and it doesn't even go to 450. And I said, "Oh, okay." And he says, "So why do you think that you're going to go 450? He says, "How much time you got in this thing?" I said, "About 30 minutes. And all the while I'm fidgeting in my pocket or something. And he looks at me and says, "Well, how fast are you going to go?" And I thought of my room key. And I pulled my room key out and it was 450. And I said, "I'm going 450. He says, "And based on the room key?" And I said, "Yeah, it's my room down at the Hilton." I said, "I'm going to go 450. And that's when he just turned around and walked back over to Dave and starts listening and over laughing at each other. And then Dave walks over to me when he left and he said, "Well, you're going to be popular. Everybody tomorrow morning while they're having their coffee is going to talk about this guy that has 30 minutes in the Mustang and he's going to go 450. And he said, "What's the odds of that?" He said, "I should give you odds and take money instead of, you know, being here for a race." But that was it. I got in the airplane and up there anyway and went out there, and I'll be damned that it was harder than it looked. And I thought it was just like, then finally I figured it's nothing more than a skip mount pass. You know, like we did, if you're bombing somebody, you got to get down where they are, right? And so I thought if I just get down into the dirt and then just do, every time you hit a pylon, it'd be another skip mount pass, that you just put them all together and you got to race. And so I went out there and tried to do that, and it worked pretty good, but I didn't quite know. And so I went back and landed again and told Dave, "Get me a motorcycle, and I'm going to go drive around here. I'm not going to fly much higher than a motorcycle anyway, so it should look the same." So that's what I did, and went out and qualified and came out to be 450.018. And somebody asked me later, he said, "Wow, you... 450.018. I mean, or 450, how do you think the Lockheed guys," because I told Dave I was going to get the Lockheed guys to tell me the power setting. And so they gave me a power setting, which was 34 and 100 and 105. inches, 105 inches, still a lot of power in the motor, but I didn't know the difference. And I didn't know whether it was running 105 or 150, you know, and or 38 or 6, nothing. Right? And anyway, I just set the numbers and went out there and it went, you know, little. And when they said, but who gave you the power setting? I said, Lockheed did. He said, wow, they're really close. I said, close. They missed it by 3 digits. but they were close, though. But anyway, that was the start.
Wow.
That's awesome. Yeah, and you went on to win the gold your first year rookie of the year then, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Wow. That's incredible.
At low power, now I'm finding out.
Yeah.
I should have had, you know, do like Tiger does. You go out there, and if you ain't reading 150, if you aren't reading in feet, you know you're not having enough power.
Yeah.
I always wondered, can you tell me the story? I know we're fighting the clock here, but we'll get maybe a couple stories in yet. What's the story with the famous photo of you flying next to the Blackbird? That's a pretty awesome photo.
Oh, yeah. Well, we came back from Reno, and Zischel, you know, being Zischel, is just figuring out how to make more money, you know, how to get Wiley to pay more money on the racer, right? And me, I don't know nothing, so I'm along for the ride. And so it's Wiley, Dave, and myself sitting in a meeting wondering what to do with the airplane. And now Dave's wondering what to do with it. Wiley knows what he wants. Wiley wants to put it in a hangar and close the door till next year. And Dave wants to work on it all year long. So anyway, we're sitting there talking, and one guy wants to work on it, one guy wants to put it in the hangar. And I said, why don't we go set a record first? You know, and I thought, well, the airplane's, if everybody thinks it's going fast, let's go set a record. And I said, it would be great if we'd use the, how about the SR airplane is the fastest jet, and then the Genie is the fastest prop. And then from both of them thought, well, we'll get the SR out here. Can we really do that? And I thought, well, we can try. So I brought her proposal. I went into CBL Park first, and my boss, and he's flown most of the Lockheed stuff and jumped out of it too, by the way. So I told him we wanted to do Genie. And the Lockheed, to their benefit, I mean, it lets you do most anything unless it's really bad news. And at the time, they were also working on Tsunami, doing the engineering, where Lockheed was. So, and we thought that'd be a good lead-in, too. You know, they're building to get rid of the old, you know, P-51 and use a new one. Yeah. So I sent a proposal to Bill Park, rather, anyway, telling what we're going to do. How do we get two airplanes in the air without the radar knowing it? He said, you can go ahead and do that. We'll give you the SR-71 flight, but you got to get your cameraman on the airplane without anybody knowing it. If you can do that, then go ahead and do it. So I thought, well, yeah, we can probably do that. And the way we did it was when the SR launched, we'd have a T-38 flying on his wing, right? And that'd be the camera guy would be in that airplane. And they'd stay on the wing. The radar would show just one blip, right, which would be the SR, the T-38s in, you know, in formation with it. Then Genie would be laying low in the bushes somewhere on one end of the runway or another with full power, trying to make that puppy go 400 knots at least. And then joining on the, when the guy, the T-38 on the wing would say, send up the other 38. So that when that 38 took off, Genie would tie into him and we'd both go up. And then the other one would come back down again. So it would look like we only had two airplanes up there when we actually had three.
That's wild.
And then we took the pictures. And then when the guy, the 138, says, I'm going to go back, you know, RTV back to Palmdale, the racer and both the 38 wouldn't leave. So the racer would get back down in the weeds again, go back to Van Nuys, and the SR would land. And when the other deal we had is if anything went wrong, Lockheed would disqualify it and would call it a hoax, and you'd be punished. This is okay, that works. But now it worked perfect. We got the pictures. Also, it was funny because the Genie, I was sitting in Genie, we're down at maybe 6,000, 7,000 feet. And the SR is looking like it's falling out of the sky. And Janie is sitting there with the nose down. Yeah. And I had full power on the thing and for a long time. And today I would think, whoa, that's a stupid thing to do over all those houses and all those other, huh? When you think of it, I mean, you're sitting alongside of a runway at full power trying to what? To get max speed out of that thing so you can join on an airplane you shouldn't even be close to.
Yeah. What do you figure? Do you remember what was your airspeed at when you were joined up?
Oh, 400.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd pumped that puppy up back in Ogden, or Acton. What's the name of that town back there? Coming down the freeway.
Wow.
And yeah, I had full power on that thing from about Acton all the way to Palmdale, and then got a visual on the SR, and then also on the 38 taking off.
Wow.
So
that's amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And I wrote it up, and anything went, had to have a disclosure there. For Bill and for a few other people. And Bill Park is a different kind of boss.
So we're going to jump way ahead to maybe the last unlimited gold you won on Dago Red. So you've been flying it for 3 or 4 years. So 2003, the Saturday race, it's the fastest race on record. If you want to tell us about that.
Yeah, it'll be the fastest race on record for a long time.
Right.
Well, here we have to give credit where credit is due,
mm-hmm. right?
And that's Didi. She's the one that came to me and told me that they were having the trophy for the first person that went 500, and that she thought that the Barrow was going to do it, and so did Reno. The Reno Association were just kind of saving it for the Bear, and because they didn't tell any of the racers. And Didi had found out because she went down and in the building down there with the administration building, and lo and behold, the thing is laying and sitting there. And it's pretty big. You know, it's like a 10-year-old kid, you know, the size of it. and so she comes and tells us that it's going to be given away, and nobody briefed us, nobody told us. Only the person that knew that, I think, was the Bear. That I, somebody that the Reno Association would get something from, I think. But anyway, all up till the race on Friday there, I mean, the Barrow was on the pole, and I was next to him. And when they came up on power, and I'd flown the Barrow before that, I know the Barrow's got a lot of power. It's got a lot of potential. All they're doing is running, stock power to some extent. You know, if I was racing the thing, that's sort of mentally what you have to think is that it's running stock power. What could be so bad about that? You know, so it's doing, 500 doing stock power. Big deal. And so anyway, I'm waiting to see what he does to figure out whether he's been told that there's a trophy down there if you get the first lap. And that's all anybody's looking at is the first lap. I tried the first to do the laps in other airplanes up there and blow the motor up. And, owners don't like it when you take the airplane and take it out and just beat it up and ruin the motor and everything else trying to get a record, because they see no logic in doing that. Now, in retrospect, we can see a lot of logic in it because it's the last race at Reno, nobody can break that Reno trophy because Reno will never happen again. So it goes on and on and on. This was the one to get because the other ones don't mean much because there's no basis on them. So here I am sitting in the cockpit, and I believe that Didi has seen the trophy and that things are ready if somebody can make the airplane go 500. So anyway, I'm sitting on the pole watching Bear, and he's coming up on the power, and I'm coming up on the power, and pretty soon I have about a mile, all that I'm going to run, which wasn't a lot of power either, really, thinking back on it. But I wanted the airplane to live for 100 miles, and not just one lap. Yeah. So anyway, I watched the Bear, and then finally figured out, he really is going for the 500. Because he's smoking along. I mean, we're both hitting 500, I'm sure, by the time we get into the bottom of that valley. And before we get to 4, we're both doing over 500. And then in the turn and coming down from 6 to the runway, we're both, over 500 there too. And at the time, I'm still not pulling a whole lot of power that I mean, it is a lot of power, but not as much as I thought it would have to do. So anyway, coming around, you know, pylon eight, then I'm pretty close. You know, I'm still in formation with them. And one thing about the difference between the Bear and the Genie is kind of like the F-4 and the 105. You know, the F-4 is a dirty pig of an airplane by a lot of power. The 105 is a nice, sleek airplane, and you don't need to use all the power. And so that's the same with Genie. So Genie is a slick airplane. The Bear is a dirty one. It's got that big prop. And if you know anything about propeller theory, it's a flat plate. That's what, you know, the real smart people tell you, that that prop out there is nothing more than a flat plate. Because I always wanted to take a racer and put chargers in it and blow the tips off of the prop. You know, when you get the airplane going really good, then hit a little button and then and blow the tips off, and now you'd have a racer. But so anyway, so we're coming right down by the home pylon there, and he's ahead, and I'm number two, and I'm like, I'm not going to add any more power because I don't quite believe they're going to give the trophy away, but I do. I believe, you know, that Didi has seen it, but they might back out of it. So anyway, all the seconds roll by, and then there's a ditch, that hole in the ground, really off the end of the runway, right? And so I thought, oh, I'll try that, see if that works. So we're both passing the whole pylon, and as I see the ditch comes up, I nose the airplane into the ditch. And you can see it on the film. You can see the airplane go down into the ditch, and the airplane thinks, I'm just supposed to go faster because I don't have to hold the airplane up. So the airplane actually does go faster, which is amazing when it's already going so fast, right? And it passes the Bear. And people thought what I had done was I had reached over and just put a whole bunch of Tiger power in it, and then the airplane would have blown up right after that. But I didn't touch anything from the time the formation started. Gentlemen, you have a race. I didn't touch any power. And also, most of the crew didn't, except for a few, didn't know I was going to run the whole. Actually, none of the crew knew I was going to fly the go the entire race over 500.
Wow.
It's amazing. And neither did the owner. Owner didn't even know the airplane was going to be in a race and try and do a record. Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing. To make things really more exciting, I married Didi, and she's the niece of the guy that owns the airplane. So not only does he own the airplane, but we're taking it out and racing it when he doesn't know anything. and trying to go an entire race over 500 when no one's ever done one lap.
Yeah. That's amazing. So it was the Thompson Trophy then that they did award to you for that race. Yep. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. I could easily sit here and have multiple parts of this, but I know we're fighting the clock. We actually went over, but that's totally fine. We're having a blast. Thank you for coming up. You're here to be part of our speaker series tomorrow night. If you're listening to this, always tune in for the speaker series. But thank you, Didi, for coming all this way to spend some time in the colder weather than you're used to. But we're looking forward to having a fun evening with you. And just thank you so much for being here, and thanks for sharing some of your stories with us.
Glad to be here. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you too, Connor, for coming on and sharing your love of air racing. For all those listening, we appreciate all the feedback you leave us. So please continue to do that. That feedback and support allows us to do this podcast. Thanks to Scott, our engineer, for running all the magic switches behind the curtain here. And we will definitely be back with you with another episode. So keep tuning in, and we'll catch you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.